Then he showed me my fast-track billing, and it said I'd driven the San Mateo Bridge 3 times that day. "That's not all," he said, and drew in a breath that let me know he was really steamed. They had information about where I'd been, places that didn't have a toll plaza. They'd been pulling my pass just on the street, at random, and it was wrong. Holy crap, I mean, they're spying on us all, and they're not even competent. I drifted down into the kitchen as he railed there, and now I was watching him from the doorway. Mom met my eye, and we both raised our eyebrows as if to say, "Who's going to say I told you so?" to him. I nodded at her. She could use her spousular powers to nullify his rage in a way that was out of my reach as a mere filial unit. "Mark," she said, and grabbed him by the arm to make him stop stalking back and forth in the kitchen, waving his arms like a street preacher.
"What?"
he snapped. "I think you owe Marcus an apology." She kept her voice even and level. Dad and I are the spazzes in the household. Mom's a total rock. Dad looked at me. His eyes narrowed as he thought for a minute.
"All right," he said at last. "You're right. I was talking about competent surveillance. These guys were total amateurs." "I'm sorry, son," he said. "You were right. That was ridiculous."
He stuck his hand out and shook my hand, then gave me a firm, unexpected hug.
"God, what are we doing to this country, Marcus? Your generation deserves to inherit something better than this."
When he let me go, I could see the deep wrinkles in his face, lines I'd never noticed. I went back up to my room and played some X-Net games. There was a good multiplayer thing, a clockwork pirate game where you had to quest every day or two to wind up your whole crew's mainsprings before you could go plundering and pillaging again. It was the kind of game I hated but couldn't stop playing. Lots of repetitive quests that weren't all that satisfying to complete, a little bit of player versus player combat, scrapping to see who would captain the ship, and not that many cool puzzles that you had to figure out. Mostly, playing this kind of game made me homesick for Harajuku Fun Madness, which balanced out running around in the real world, figuring out online puzzles, and strategizing with your team. But today, it was just what I needed. Mindless entertainment. My poor dad. I'd done that to him. He'd been happy before, confident that his tax dollars were being spent to keep him safe. I'd destroyed that confidence. It was false confidence, of course, but it had kept him going. Seeing him now, miserable and broken, I wondered if it was better to be clear-eyed and hopeless or to live in a fool's paradise. That shame, the shame I'd felt since I gave up my passwords, since they'd broken me, returned, leaving me listless and wanting to just get away from myself. My character was a swabby on the pirate ship, Zombie Charger, and he'd wound down while I'd been offline. I had to IM all the other players on my ship until I found one willing to wind me up. That kept me occupied. I liked it, actually. There was something magic about a total stranger doing you a favor. And since it was the X-Net, I knew that all the strangers were friends, in some sense.
"Where are you located?"
The character who wound me up was called Lizinator, and it was female, though that didn't mean that it was a girl. Guys had some weird affinity for playing female characters.
"San Francisco," I said. "No, Stoop, where are you located in San Fran?"
"Why, you a pervert?"
That usually shut down that line of conversation. Of course, every game space was full of pedos and pervs, and cops pretending to be pedo and perv bait, though I sure hoped there weren't any cops on the X-Net. An accusation like that was enough to change the subject 9 out of 10 times.
"Mission? Potrero Hill? Noe? East Bay?"
"Just wind me up, Kay. Thanks."
She stopped winding.
"You scared?"
"Safe. Why do you care?"
"Just curious. I was getting a bad vibe off her. She was clearly more than just curious. Call it paranoia. I logged off and shut down my Xbox. Dad looked at me over the table the next morning and said, "It looks like it's going to get better, at least." He handed me a copy of the Chronicle open to the third page. A Department of Homeland Security spokesman has confirmed that the San Francisco office has requested a 300% budget and personnel increase from Washington, D.C.
What?
Major General Graham Sutherland, the commanding officer for Northern California DHS operations, confirmed the request at a press conference yesterday, noting that a spike in suspicious activity in the Bay Area prompted the request. "We are tracking a spike in underground chatter and activity and believe that saboteurs are deliberately manufacturing false security alerts to undermine our efforts." My eyes crossed.
No freaking way.
"These false alarms are potentially radar chaff intended to disguise real attacks. The only effective way of combating them is to step up staffing and analyst levels so that we can fully investigate every lead." Sutherland noted the delays experienced all over the city were unfortunate and committed to eliminating them. I had a vision of the city with 4 or 5 times as many DHS enforcers brought in to make up for my own stupid ideas. Van was right. The more I fought them, the worse it was going to get. Dad pointed at the paper. "These guys may be fools, but they're methodical fools. They'll just keep throwing resources at this problem until they solve it. It's tractable, you know. Mining all the data in the city, following up on every lead. They'll catch the terrorists." I lost it.
"Dad, are you listening to yourself? They're talking about investigating practically every person in the city of San Francisco."
"Yeah," he said. "That's right. They'll catch every alimony cheat, every dope dealer, every dirtbag, and every terrorist. You just wait. This could be the best thing that ever happened to this country."
"Tell me you're joking," I said. "I beg you. You think that that's what they intended when they wrote the Constitution? What about the Bill of Rights?"
"The Bill of Rights was written before data mining," he said. He was awesomely serene, convinced of his rightness. "The right to freedom of association is fine, but why shouldn't the cops be allowed to mine your social network to figure out if you're hanging out with gangbangers and terrorists?"
"Because it's an invasion of my privacy," I said.
"What's the big deal? Would you rather have privacy or terrorists?"
Ugh, I hated arguing with my dad like this. I needed a coffee. "Dad, come on. Taking away our privacy isn't catching terrorists. It's just inconveniencing normal people."
"How do you know it's not catching terrorists?"
"Where are the terrorists they've caught?"
"I'm sure we'll see arrests in good time. You just wait."
"Dad, what the hell has happened to you since last night? You were ready to go nuclear on the cops for pulling you over."
"Don't use that tone with me, Marcus. What's happened since last night is that I've had the chance to think it over and to read this." He rattled his paper. "The reason they caught me is that the bad guys are actively jamming them. They need to adjust their techniques to overcome the jamming. But they'll get there. Meanwhile, the occasional road stop is a small price to pay. This isn't the time to be playing lawyer about the Bill of Rights. This is the time to make some sacrifices to keep our city safe." I couldn't finish my toast. I put the plate in the dishwasher and left for school. I had to get out of there.
The X-Netters weren't happy about the stepped-up police surveillance, but they weren't going to take it lying down. Someone called a phone-in show on KQED and told them that the police were wasting their time, that we could monkey-wrench the system faster than they could untangle it. The recording was a top XNet download that night.
"This is California Live, and we're talking to an anonymous caller at a payphone in San Francisco. He has his own information about the slowdowns we've been facing around town this week. Caller, you're on the air."
"Yeah, yo, this is just the beginning, you know?
I mean, like, we're just getting started. Let them hire a billion pigs and put a checkpoint on every corner. We'll jam them all. And, like, all this crap about terrorists? We're not terrorists. Give me a break. I mean, really. We're jamming up the system because we hate the Homeland Security and because we love our city. Terrorists? I can't even spell jihad. Peace out. He sounded like an idiot. Not just the incoherent words, but also his gloating tone. He sounded like a kid who was indecently proud of himself. He was a kid who was indecently proud of himself. The X-Net flamed out over this. Lots of people thought he was an idiot for calling in, while others thought he was a hero. I worried that there was probably a camera aimed at the payphone he'd used, or an RFID reader that might have sniffed his fast pass. I hoped he'd had the smarts to wipe his fingerprints off the quarter, keep his hood up and leave all his RFIDs at home, but I doubted it. I wondered if he'd get a knock on the door sometime soon. The way I knew when something big had happened on XNet was that I'd suddenly get a million emails from people who wanted Mikey to know about the latest haps. It was just as I was reading about Mr. Can't Spell Jihad that my mailbox went crazy. Everyone had a message for me, a link to a live journal on the XNet, one of the many anonymous blogs that were based on the Freenet document publishing system that was also used by Chinese democracy advocates. Close call. We were jamming at the Embarcadero tonight and goofing around giving everyone a new car key or door key or fast pass or fast track, tossing around a little fake gunpowder. There were cops everywhere, but we were smarter than them. We're there pretty much every night, and we never get caught. So we got caught tonight. It was a stupid mistake. We got sloppy. We got busted. It was an undercover who caught my pal and then got the rest of us. They'd been watching the crowd for a long time, and they had one of those trucks nearby, and they took four of us in but missed the rest. The truck was jammed, like a can of sardines, with every kind of person, old, young, black, white, rich, poor, all suspects, and there were two cops trying to ask us questions, and the undercovers kept bringing in more of us. Most people were trying to get to the front of the line to get through questioning, so we kept on moving back, and it was like hours in there, and really hot, and it was getting more crowded, not less. At like 8 p.m., they changed shifts, and two new cops came in and bawled out the two cops who were there, all like, "WTF, aren't you doing anything here?" They had a real fight, and then the two old cops left, and the new cops sat down at their desks and whispered to each other for a while. Then one cop stood up and started shouting, "Everyone just go home. Jesus Christ, we've got better things to do than bother you with more questions. If you've done something wrong, just don't do it again, and let this be a warning to you all." A bunch of the suits got really pissed, which was hilarious, because, I mean, 10 minutes before, they were bugging about being held there, and now they were wicked pissed about being let go. Like, make up your minds. We split fast, though, and got out and came home to write this. There are undercovers everywhere. Believe. If you're jamming, be open-eyed and get ready to run when problems happen. If you get caught, try to wait it out. They're so busy they'll maybe just let you go. We made them that busy. All those people in that truck were there because we'd jammed them. So jam on! I felt like I was going to throw up. Those four people. Kids I'd never met. They nearly went away forever because of something I'd started. Because of something I'd told them to do. I was no better than a terrorist. The DHS got their budget requisition approved. The president went on TV with the governor to tell us that no price was too high for security. We had to watch it the next day in school at assembly. My dad cheered. He'd hated the president since the day he was elected, saying he wasn't any better than the last guy, and the last guy had been a complete disaster.
But now all he could do was talk about how decisive and dynamic the new guy was. "You have to take it easy on your father," Mom said to me one night after I got home from school. She'd been working from home as much as possible. Mom's a freelance relocation specialist who helps British people get settled in San Francisco. The UK High Commission pays her to answer emails from mystified British people across the country who are totally confused by how freaky we Americans are. She explains Americans for a living, and she said that these days it was better to do that from home, where she didn't have to actually see any Americans or talk to them. I don't have any illusions about Britain. America may be willing to trash its constitution every time some jihadist looks cross-eyed at us, but as I learned in my 9th grade social studies independent project, the Brits don't even have a constitution. They've got laws there that would curl the hair on your toes. They can put you in jail for an entire year if they're really sure that you're a terrorist but don't have enough evidence to prove it. Now, how sure can they be if they don't have enough evidence to prove it? How'd they get that sure? Did they see you committing terrorist acts in a really vivid dream? And the surveillance in Britain makes America look like amateur hour. The average Londoner is photographed 500 times a day, just walking around the streets. Every license plate is photographed at every corner in the country. Everyone from the banks to the public transit company is enthusiastic about tracking you and snitching on you if they think you're remotely suspicious. But Mom didn't see it that way. She'd left Britain halfway through high school, and she'd never felt at home here, no matter that she'd married a boy from Petaluma and raised a son here. To her, this was always the land of barbarians, and Britain would always be home. "Mom, he's just wrong. You of all people should know that. Everything that makes this country great is being flushed down the toilet, and he's going along with it. Have you noticed that they haven't caught any terrorists? Dad's all like, 'We need to be safe,' but he needs to know that most of us don't feel safe. We feel endangered all the time." "I know this all, Marcus. Believe me, I'm not a fan of what's been happening to this country. But your father is..." She broke off. "When you didn't come home after the attacks, he thought..." She got up and made herself a cup of tea, something she did whenever she was uncomfortable or disconcerted. "Marcus," she said. "Marcus, we thought you were dead. Do you understand that? We were mourning you for days. We were imagining you blown to bits at the bottom of the ocean. Dead because some bastard decided to kill hundreds of strangers to make some point." That sank in slowly. "I mean, I understood that they'd been worried. Lots of people died in the bombings. 4,000 was the present estimate. And practically everyone knew someone who didn't come home that day. There were 2 people from my school who had disappeared. Your father was ready to kill someone. Anyone. He was out of his mind. You've never seen him like this. I've never seen him like it either. He was out of his mind. He'd just sit at this table and curse and curse and curse. Vile words. Words I'd never heard him say. One day, the 3rd day, someone called and he was sure it was you. But it was a wrong number and he threw the phone so hard it disintegrated into thousands of pieces." I'd wondered about the new kitchen phone. "Something broke in your father. He loves you. We both love you. You're the most important thing in our lives. I don't think you realize that. Do you remember when you were 10, when I went home to London for all that time? Do you remember?" I nodded silently. "We were ready to get a divorce, Marcus. Oh, it doesn't matter why anymore. It was just a bad patch, the kind of thing that happens when people who love each other stop paying attention for a few years. He came and got me and convinced me to come back for you. We couldn't bear the thought of doing that to you.
We fell in love again for you. We're together today because of you.
I had a lump in my throat. I'd never known this. No one had ever told me.
So your father is having a hard time right now. He's not in his right mind. It's going to take some time before he comes back to us, before he's the man I love again. We need to understand him until then.
She gave me a long hug, and I noticed how thin her arms had gotten, how saggy the skin on her neck was. I always thought of my mother as young, pale, rosy-cheeked and cheerful, peering shrewdly through her metal-rimmed glasses. Now she looked a little like an old woman. I had done that to her. The terrorists had done that to her. The Department of Homeland Security had done that to her. In a weird way, we were all on the same side. And Mom and Dad and all those people we'd spoofed were on the other side. I couldn't sleep that night. Mom's words kept running through my head. Dad had been tense and quiet at dinner, and we'd barely spoken, because I didn't trust myself not to say the wrong thing, and because he was all wound up over the latest news that Al-Qaeda was definitely responsible for the bombing. 6 different terrorist groups had claimed responsibility for the attack, but only Al-Qaeda's internet video disclosed information that the DHS said they hadn't disclosed to anyone. I lay in bed and listened to a late-night call-in radio show. The topic was sex problems, with this gay guy who I normally loved to listen to. He would give people such raw advice, but good advice, and he was really funny and campy. Tonight I couldn't laugh. Most of the callers wanted to ask what to do about the fact that they were having a hard time getting busy with their partners ever since the attack. Even on sex talk radio, I couldn't get away from the topic. I switched the radio off and heard a purring engine on the street below. My bedroom is in the top floor of our house, one of the painted ladies. I have a sloping attic ceiling and windows on both sides. One overlooks the whole mission. The other looks out into the street in front of our place. There were often cars cruising at all hours of the night, but there was something different about this engine noise. I went to the street window and pulled up my blinds. Down on the street below me was a white, unmarked van whose roof was festooned with radio antennas, more antennas than I'd ever seen on a car. It was cruising very slowly down the street, a little dish on top, spinning around and around. As I watched, the van stopped, and one of the back doors popped open. A guy in a DHS uniform, I could spot one from 100 yards now, stepped out into the street. He had some kind of handheld device, and its blue glow lit his face. He paced back and forth, first scouting my neighbors, making notes on his device, then heading for me. There was something familiar in the way he walked, looking down. He was using a Wi-Finder. The DHS was scouting for XNet nodes. I let go of the blinds and dove across my room for my Xbox. I'd left it up while I downloaded some cool animations one of the XNetters had made of the president's No Price Too High speech. I yanked the plug out of the wall, then scurried back to the window and cracked the blind a fraction of an inch. The guy was looking down into his Wi-Finder again, walking back and forth in front of our house. A moment later, he got back into his van and drove away. I got out my camera and took as many pictures as I could of the van and its antennas. Then I opened them in a free image editor called the GIMP and edited out everything from the photo except the van, erasing my street and anything that might identify me. I posted them to XNet and wrote down everything I could about the vans. These guys were definitely looking for the XNet. I could tell. Now I really couldn't sleep. Nothing for it but to play wind-up pirates. There'd be lots of players, even at this hour. The real name for wind-up pirates was Clockwork Plunder, and it was a hobbyist project that had been created by teenage death metal freaks from Finland. It was totally free to play and offered just as much fun as any of the $15 a month services like Ender's Universe and Middle Earth Quest and Discworld Dungeons. I logged back in, and there I was, still on the deck of the zombie charger, waiting for someone to wind me up. I hated this part of the game. "Hey, you," I typed to a passing pirate. "Wind me up?" He paused and looked at me. "Why should I? We're on the same team, plus you get experience points." What a jerk. "Where are you located?" "San Francisco." This was starting to feel familiar. "Where in San Francisco?" I logged out. There was something weird going on in the game. I jumped onto the live journals and began to crawl from blog to blog. I got through half a dozen before I found something that froze my blood. Live journalers love quizzes. What kind of hobbit are you? Are you a great lover? What planet are you most like? Which character from some movie are you? What's your emotional type? They fill them in and their friends fill them in, and everyone compares their results. Harmless fun. But the quiz that had taken over the blogs of the X-Net that night was what scared me, because it was anything but harmless. What's your sex? What grade are you in? What school do you go to? Where in the city do you live? The quizzes plotted the results on a map with colored pushpins for schools and neighborhoods, and made lame recommendations for places to buy pizza and stuff. But look at those questions. Think about my answers. Male. 17. Chavez High. Potrero Hill. There were only two people in my whole school who matched that profile. Most schools, it would be the same. If you wanted to figure out who the X-Netters were, you could use these quizzes to find them all. That was bad enough, but what was worse was what it implied. Someone from the DHS was using the X-Net to get at us. The X-Net was compromised by the DHS. We had spies in our midst. I'd given X-Net discs to hundreds of people, and they'd done the same. I knew the people I gave the discs to pretty well. Some of them I knew very well. I've lived in the same house all my life, and I've made hundreds and hundreds of friends over the years, from people who went to daycare with me to people I played soccer with, people who LARPed with me, people I met clubbing, people I knew from school. My ARG team were my closest friends, but there were plenty of people I knew and trusted enough to hand an X-Net disc to. I needed them now. I woke Holu up by ringing his cell phone and hanging up after the first ring, 3 times in a row. A minute later, he was up on X-Net, and we were able to have a secure chat. I pointed him to my blog post on the radio vans, and he came back a minute later, all freaked out. "You sure they're looking for us?" In response, I sent him to the quiz. "OMG, we're doomed." "No, it's not that bad, but we need to figure out who we can trust." "How?" "That's what I wanted to ask you. How many people can you totally vouch for, like trust them to the ends of the earth?" 20 or 30 or so. I want to get a bunch of really trustworthy people together and do a key exchange web of trust thing. Web of trust is one of those cool crypto things that I'd read about but never tried. It was a nearly foolproof way to make sure that you could talk to the people you trusted, but that no one else could listen in. The problem is that it requires you to physically meet with the people in the web at least once, just to get started. "I get it, sure. That's not bad. But how are you going to get everyone together for the key signing?" "That's what I wanted to ask you about. How can we do it without getting busted?" Holu typed some words and erased them, typed more and erased them. "Daryl would know," I typed. God, this was the stuff he was great at. Holu didn't type anything. Then, "How about a party?" he typed. "How about if we all get together somewhere, like we're teenagers having a party, and that way we'll have a ready-made excuse if anyone shows up asking us what we're doing there.
That would totally work. You're a genius, Holu.
I know it. And you're going to love this. I know just where to do it, too.
Where?
Sutro Baths. Chapter 10.
What would you do if you found out you had a spy in your midst? You could denounce him, put him up against the wall, and take him out. But then you might end up with another spy in your midst, and the new spy would be more careful than the last one and maybe not get caught quite so readily. Here's a better idea. Start intercepting the spy's communications and feed him and his masters misinformation. Say his masters instruct him to gather information on your movements. Let him follow you around and take all the notes he wants, but steam open the envelopes that he sends back to HQ and replace his account of your movements with a fictitious one. If you want, you can make him seem erratic and unreliable so they get rid of him. You can manufacture crises that might make one side or the other reveal the identities of other spies. In short, you own them. This is called the man-in-the-middle attack, and if you think about it, it's pretty scary. Someone who man-in-the-middles your communications can trick you in any of a thousand ways. Of course, there's a great way to get around the man-in-the-middle attack. Use crypto. With crypto, it doesn't matter if the enemy can see your messages, because he can't decipher them, change them, and resend them. That's one of the main reasons to use crypto. But remember, for crypto to work, you need to have keys for the people you want to talk to. You and your partner need to share a secret or two, some keys that you can use to encrypt and decrypt your messages so that men in the middle get locked out. That's where the idea of public keys comes in. This is a little hairy, but it's so unbelievably elegant, too. In public key crypto, each user gets two keys. They're long strings of mathematical gibberish, and they have an almost magic property. Whatever you scramble with one key, the other will unlock, and vice versa. What's more, they're the only keys that can do this. If you can unscramble a message with one key, you know it was scrambled with the other, and vice versa. So you take either one of these keys, it doesn't matter which one, and you just publish it. You make it a total non-secret. You want anyone in the world to know what it is. For obvious reasons, they call this your public key. The other key, you hide in the darkest reaches of your mind. You protect it with your life. You never let anyone ever know what it is. That's called your private key. Duh. Now say you're a spy and you want to talk with your bosses. Their public key is known by everyone. Your public key is known by everyone. No one knows your private key but you. No one knows their private key but them. You want to send them a message. First, you encrypt it with your private key. You could just send that message along and it would work pretty well since they would know when the message arrived that it came from you. How? Because if they can decrypt it with your public key, it can only have been encrypted with your private key. This is the equivalent of putting your seal or signature on the bottom of a message. It says, I wrote this and no one else. No one could have tampered with it or changed it. Unfortunately, this won't actually keep your message a secret. That's because your public key is really well known. It has to be, or you'll be limited to sending messages to those few people who have your public key. Anyone who intercepts the message can read it. They can't change it and make it seem like it came from you, but if you don't want people to know what you're saying, you need a better solution. So instead of just encrypting the message with your private key, you also encrypt it with your boss's public key. Now it's been locked twice. The first lock, the boss's public key, only comes off when combined with your boss's private key. The second lock, your private key, only comes off with your public key. When your bosses receive the message, they unlock it with both keys
and now they know for sure that, A, you wrote it, and B, only they can read it. It's very cool. The day I discovered it, Daryl and I immediately exchanged keys and spent months cackling and rubbing our hands as we exchanged our military-grade secret messages about where to meet after school and whether Van would ever notice him. But if you want to understand security, you need to consider the most paranoid possibilities. Like, what if I tricked you into thinking that my public key was your boss's public key? You'd encrypt the message with your private key and my public key. I'd decrypt it, read it, re-encrypt it with your boss's real public key, and send it on. As far as your boss knows, no one but you could have written the message, and no one but him could have read it. And I get to sit in the middle, like a fat spider in a web, and all your secrets belong to me. Now, the easiest way to fix this is to really widely advertise your public key. If it's really easy for anyone to know what your real key is, man in the middle gets harder and harder. But you know what? Making things well known is just as hard as keeping them secret. Think about it. How many billions of dollars are spent on shampoo ads and other crap just to make sure that as many people know about something that some advertiser wants them to know? There's a cheaper way of fixing man in the middle, the web of trust. Say that before you leave HQ, you and your bosses sit down over coffee and actually tell each other your keys. No more man in the middle. You're absolutely certain whose keys you have, because they were put into your own hands. So far, so good. But there's a natural limit to this. How many people can you physically meet with and swap keys? How many hours in the day do you want to devote to the equivalent of writing your own phone book? How many of those people are willing to devote that kind of time to you? Thinking about this like a phone book helps. The world was once a place with a lot of phone books, and when you needed a number, you could look it up in the book. But for many of the numbers that you wanted to refer to on a given day, you would either know it by heart or you'd be able to ask someone else. Even today, when I'm out with my cell phone, I'll ask Holu or Daryl if they have a number I'm looking for. It's faster and easier than looking it up online, and they're more reliable, too. If Holu has a number, I trust him, so I trust the number, too. That's called transitive trust. Trust that moves across the web of our relationships. A web of trust is a bigger version of this. Say I meet Holu and get his key. I can put it on my key ring, a list of keys that I've signed with my private key. That means you can unlock it with my public key and know for sure that me, or someone with my key anyway, says that this key belongs to this guy. So I hand you my key ring. And provided that you trust me to have actually met and verified all the keys on it, you can take it and add it to your key ring. Now you meet someone else, and you hand the whole ring to him. Bigger and bigger the ring grows. And provided that you trust the next guy in the chain, and he trusts the next guy in his chain, and so on, you're pretty secure. Which brings me to key signing parties. These are exactly what they sound like. A party where everyone gets together and signs everyone else's keys. Daryl and I, when we traded keys, that was kind of a mini key signing party. One with only two sad and geeky attendees. But with more people, you create the seed of the web of trust, and the web can expand from there. As everyone on your key ring goes out into the world and meets more people, they can add more and more names to the ring. You don't have to meet the new people. Just trust that the signed key you get from the people in your web is valid. So that's why web of trust and parties go together like peanut butter and chocolate. Just tell them it's a super private party, invitational only, I said. Tell them not to bring anyone along or they won't be admitted. Holu looked at me over his coffee. You're joking, right? You tell people that, and they'll bring extra friends.
Ah,
I said. I spent a night a week at Holu's these days, keeping the code up to date on IndyNet. Pigspleen actually paid me a non-zero sum of money to do this, which was really weird. I never thought I'd be paid to write code. So what do we do? We only want people we really trust there, and we don't want to mention why until we've got everyone's keys and can send them messages in secret. Holu debugged, and I watched over his shoulder. This used to be called extreme programming, which was a little embarrassing. Now we just call it programming. Two people are much better at spotting bugs than one. As the cliche goes, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. We were working our way through the bug reports and getting ready to push out the new rev. It all auto-updated in the background, so our users didn't really need to do anything. They just woke up once a week or so with a better program. It was pretty freaky to know that the code I wrote would be used by hundreds of thousands of people tomorrow. What do we do? Man, I don't know. I think we just have to live with it. I thought back to our Harajuku Fun Madness days. There were lots of social challenges involving large groups of people as part of that game. Okay, you're right. But let's at least try to keep this secret. Tell them that they can bring a maximum of one person, and it has to be someone they've known personally for a minimum of 5 years. Holu looked up from the screen. Hey, he said. Hey, that would totally work. I can really see it. I mean, if you told me not to bring anyone, I'd be all, who the hell does he think he is? But when you put it that way, it sounds like some awesome 007 stuff. I found a bug. We drank some coffee. I went home and played a little Clockwork Plunder, trying not to think about keywinders with nosy questions, and slept like a baby. Sutro Baths are San Francisco's authentic, fake Roman ruins. When it opened in 1896, it was the largest indoor bathing house in the world, a huge Victorian glass solarium filled with pools and tubs and even an early water slide. It went downhill by the 50s, and the owners torched it for the insurance in 1966. All that's left is a labyrinth of weathered stone set into the sheer cliff face at Ocean Beach. It looks for all the world like a Roman ruin, crumbled and mysterious, and just beyond it is a set of caves that let out into the sea. In rough tides, the waves rush through the caves and over the ruins. They've even been known to suck in and drown the occasional tourist. Ocean Beach is way out past Golden Gate Park, a stark cliff lined with expensive, doomed houses, plunging down to a narrow beach studded with jellyfish and brave, insane, surfers. There's a giant white rock that juts out of the shallows off the shore. That's called Seal Rock, and it used to be the place where the sea lions congregated until they were relocated to the more tourist-friendly environs of Fisherman's Wharf. After dark, there's hardly anyone out there. It gets very cold, with a salt spray that'll soak you to your bones if you let it. The rocks are sharp, and there's broken glass, and the occasional junkie needle. It is an awesome place for a party. Bringing along the tarpaulins and chemical glove warmers was my idea. Holu figured out where to get the beer. His older brother, Javier, had a buddy who actually operated a whole underage drinking service. Pay him enough, and he'd back up to your scheduled party spot with ice chests and as many brews as you wanted. I blew a bunch of my IndieNet programming money, and the guy showed up right on time, 8 p.m., a good hour after sunset, and lugged the 6 foam ice chests out of his pickup truck and down into the ruins of the baths. He even brought a spare chest for the empties. "You kids play safe now," he said, tipping his cowboy hat. He was a fat Samoan guy with a huge smile and a scary tank top that you could see his armpit and belly and shoulder hair escaping from. I peeled 20s off my roll and handed them to him. His markup was 150%. Not a bad racket. He looked at my roll. "You know, I could just take that from you," he said, still smiling. "I'm a criminal after all." I put my roll in my pocket and looked him levelly in the eye. I'd been stupid to show him what I was carrying, but I knew that there were times when you should just stand your ground.
"I'm just messing with you," he said at last. "But you be careful with that money. Don't go showing it around."
"Thanks," I said. "Homeland Security will get my back, though." His smile got even bigger.
"Ha! They're not even real 5-0. Those Peckerwoods don't know nothing."
I looked over at his truck. Prominently displayed in his windscreen was a fast track. I wondered how long it would be until he got busted.
"You got girls coming tonight? That why you got all the beer?"
I smiled and waved at him as though he was walking back to his truck, which he should have been doing. He eventually got the hint and drove away. His smile never faltered. Holu helped me hide the coolers in the rubble, working with little white LED torches on headbands. Once the coolers were in place, we threw little white LED keychains into each one so it would glow when you took the styrofoam lid off, making it easier to see what you were doing. It was a moonless night and overcast, and the distant streetlights barely illuminated us. I knew we'd stand out like blazes on an infrared scope, but there was no chance that we'd be able to get a bunch of people together without being observed. I'd settle for being dismissed as a little drunken beach party. I don't really drink much. There's been beer and pot and ecstasy at the parties I've been going to since I was 14, but I hated smoking, though I'm quite partial to a hash brownie every now and again. Ecstasy took too long. Who's got a whole weekend to get high and come down? And beer, well, it was all right, but I didn't see what the big deal was. My favorite was big, elaborate cocktails, the kind of thing served in a ceramic volcano with 6 layers on fire and a plastic monkey on the rim. But that was mostly for the theater of it all. I actually like being drunk. I just don't like being hungover. And boy, do I ever get hungover. Though again, that might have to do with the kind of drinks that come in a ceramic volcano. But you can't throw a party without putting a case or two of beer on ice. It's expected. It loosens things up. People do stupid things after too many beers, but it's not like my friends are the kind of people who have cars. And people do stupid things no matter what. Beer or grass or whatever are all incidental to that central fact. Holu and I each cracked beers. Anchor Steam for him, a Bud Light for me, and clinked the bottles together, sitting down on a rock.
"You told them 9 p.m.?"
"Yeah," he said. "Me too." We drank in silence. The Bud Light was the least alcoholic thing in the ice chest. I'd need a clear head later. "You ever get scared?" I said finally. He turned to me.
"No, man, I don't get scared. I'm always scared. I've been scared since the minute the explosions happened. I'm so scared sometimes, I don't want to get out of bed."
"Then why do you do it?" He smiled. "About that," he said. "Maybe I won't. Not for much longer. I mean, it's been great helping you. Great. Really excellent. I don't know when I've done anything so important. But Marcus, bro, I have to say..." He trailed off.
"What?"
I said, though I knew what was coming next.
"I can't do it forever," he said at last.
"Maybe not even for another month. I think I'm through. It's too much risk. The DHS, you can't go to war on them. It's crazy. Really, actually crazy."
"You sound like Van," I said.
My voice was much more bitter than I'd intended.
"I'm not criticizing you, man. I think it's great that you've got the bravery to do this all the time. But I haven't got it. I can't live my life in perpetual terror."
"What are you saying?"
"I'm saying I'm out. I'm going to be one of those people who acts like it's all okay, like it'll all go back to normal someday. I'm going to use the internet like I always did, and only use the XNet to play games. I'm going to get out, is what I'm saying. I won't be a part of your plans anymore."
I didn't say anything.
"I know that's leaving you on your own. I don't want that. Believe me, I'd much rather you give up with me. You can't declare war on the government of the USA. It's not a fight you're going to win. Watching you try is like watching a bird fly into a window again and again.
He wanted me to say something. What I wanted to say was, Jesus, Holu, thanks so very much for abandoning me. Do you forget what it was like when they took us away? Do you forget what the country used to be like before they took it over?
But that's not what he wanted me to say. What he wanted me to say was, I understand, Holu. I respect your choice.
He drank the rest of his beer and pulled out another one and twisted off the cap.
There's something else, he said.
What?
I wasn't going to mention it, but I want you to understand why I have to do this.
Jesus, Holu, what?
I hate to say it, but you're white. I'm not. White people get caught with cocaine and do a little rehab time. Brown people get caught with crack and go to prison for 20 years. White people see cops on the street and feel safer. Brown people see cops on the street and wonder if they're about to get searched. The way the DHS is treating you, the law in this country has always been like that for us.
It was so unfair. I didn't ask to be white. I didn't think I was being braver just because I'm white. But I knew what Holu was saying. If the cops stopped someone in the mission and asked to see some ID, chances were that person wasn't white. Whatever risk I ran, Holu ran more. Whatever penalty I'd pay, Holu would pay more.
I don't know what to say, I said.
You don't have to say anything, he said. I just wanted you to know, so you could understand.
I could see people walking down the side trail toward us. They were friends of Holu's, two Mexican guys, and a girl I knew from around, short and geeky, always wearing cute black Buddy Holly glasses that made her look like the outcast art student in a teen movie who comes back as the big success. Holu introduced me and gave them beers. The girl didn't take one, but instead produced a small silver flask of vodka from her purse and offered me a drink. I took a swallow, warm vodka must be an acquired taste, and complimented her on the flask, which was embossed with a repeating motif of Parappa the Rapper characters.
It's Japanese, she said as I played another LED key ring over it. They have all these great booze toys based on kids' games, totally twisted.
I introduced myself, and she introduced herself.
Ange,
she said, and shook my hand with hers. Dry, warm, with short nails. Holu introduced me to his pals, whom he'd known since computer camp in the fourth grade. More people showed up. 5, then 10, then 20. It was a seriously big group now. We'd told people to arrive by 9:30 sharp, and we gave it until 9:45 to see who all would show up. About 3/4 were Holu's friends. I'd invited all the people I really trusted. Either I was more discriminating than Holu, or less popular. Now that he'd told me he was quitting, it made me think that he was less discriminating. I was really pissed at him, but trying not to let it show by concentrating on socializing with other people. But he wasn't stupid. He knew what was going on. I could see that he was really bummed.
Good.
Okay, I said, climbing up on a ruin. Okay, hey, hello? A few people nearby paid attention to me, but the ones in the back kept on chatting. I put my arms in the air like a referee, but it was too dark. Eventually, I hit on the idea of turning my LED keychain on and pointing it at each of the talkers in turn, then at me. Gradually, the crowd fell quiet. I welcomed them and thanked them all for coming, then asked them to close in so I could explain why we were there. I could tell they were into the secrecy of it all, intrigued and a little warmed up by the beer. So here it is. You all use the X-Net. It's no coincidence that the X-Net was created right after the DHS took over the city. The people who did that are an organization devoted to personal liberty, who created the network to keep us safe from DHS spooks and enforcers.
Holu and I had worked this out in advance. We weren't going to cop to being behind it all, not to anyone. It was way too risky. Instead, we'd put it out that we were merely lieutenants in Mikey's army, acting to organize the local resistance. "The X-Net isn't pure," I said. "It can be used by the other side just as readily as by us. We know that there are DHS spies who use it now. They use social engineering hacks to try to get us to reveal ourselves so that they can bust us. If the X-Net is going to succeed, we need to figure out how to keep them from spying on us. We need a network within the network." I paused and let this sink in. Holu had suggested that this might be a little heavy, learning that you're about to be brought into a revolutionary cell. "Now, I'm not here to ask you to do anything active. You don't have to go out jamming or anything. You've been brought here because we know you're cool. We know you're trustworthy. It's that trustworthiness I want to get you to contribute tonight. Some of you will already be familiar with the web of trust and key signing parties, but for the rest of you, I'll run it down quickly." Which I did. "Now, what I want from you tonight is to meet the people here and figure out how much you can trust them. We're going to help you generate key pairs and share them with each other." This part was tricky. Asking people to bring their own laptops wouldn't have worked out, but we still needed to do something hella complicated that wouldn't exactly work with paper and pencil. I held up a laptop Holu and I had rebuilt the night before, from the ground up. "I trust this machine. Every component in it was laid by our own hands. It's running a fresh-out-of-the-box version of Paranoid Linux, booted off of the DVD. If there's a trustworthy computer left anywhere in the world, this might well be it. I've got a key generator loaded here. You come up here and give it some random input, mash the keys, wiggle the mouse, and it will use that as the seed to create a random public and private key for you, which it will display on the screen. You can take a picture of the private key with your phone and hit any key to make it go away forever. It's not stored on the disk at all. Then it will show you your public key. At that point, you call over all the people here you trust and who trust you, and they take a picture of the screen with you standing next to it, so they know whose key it is. When you get home, you have to convert the photos to keys. This is going to be a lot of work, I'm afraid, but you'll only have to do it once. You have to be super careful about typing these in. One mistake, and you're screwed. Luckily, we've got a way to tell if you've got it right. Beneath the key will be a much shorter number called the fingerprint. Once you've typed in the key, you can generate a fingerprint from it and compare it to the fingerprint. And if they match, you've got it right. They all boggled at me. Okay, so I'd ask them to do something pretty weird. It's true. But still. Chapter 11. Holu stood up. "This is where it starts, guys. This is how we know which side you're on. You might not be willing to take to the streets and get busted for your beliefs, but if you have beliefs, this will let us know it. This will create the web of trust that tells us who's in and who's out. If we're ever going to get our country back, we need to do this. We need to do something like this." Someone in the audience, it was Ange, had a hand up, holding a beer bottle. "So, call me stupid, but I don't understand this at all. Why do you want us to do this?" Holu looked at me, and I looked back at him. It had all seemed so obvious when we were organizing it. "The X-Net isn't just a way to play free games. It's the last open communications network in America. It's the last way to communicate without being snooped on by the DHS. For it to work, we need to know that the person we're talking to isn't a snoop. That means that we need to know that the people we're sending messages to are the people we think they are. That's where you come in. You're all here because we trust you. I mean, really trust you. Trust you with our lives." Some of the people groaned. It sounded melodramatic and stupid. I got back to my feet. "When the bombs went off," I said, and then something welled up in my chest. something painful. When the bombs went off, there were four of us caught up by Market Street. For whatever reason, the DHS decided that made us suspicious. They put bags over our heads.